still looking?
There are only two. Only one is relevant. Okay, guys ready? Should I wait another few minutes? I guess for the back to fill in. Okay. Okay. Okay, let's get going. Okay, the notes for today's lecture ran a little long. And the main reason for that is that apparently I need to teach you some quantum field theory in order to do the physics that I wanted to do today. But it is absolutely essential for the study of the strong interactions to actually have this material. I'm still going to take some shortcuts. Hopefully, all shortcuts that I take will be remedied by Callum this afternoon. Okay. So I'll repeat. Hopefully, all shortcuts that I take will be remedied by Callum this afternoon. Okay. In the previous few lectures, we've been studying. In the previous few lectures, we've been studying the phenomenology of the strong interactions at very high energy. And again, we've come to this very paradoxical situation that on the one hand, at large distances, the strong interactions are not only strong, but they're extremely strong. So strong that they permanently confine quarks into bound states, the mesons and baryons. On the other hand, when we think about the strong interactions at short distances, we found that what experiment tells us is that those interactions are weak. So in particular, when quarks and antiquarks interact with one another, they can't transfer large momentum. So jets are narrow. The proton is well approximated by partons that are approximately collinearly moving with the proton. We also saw that the quarkonia are explained by a theory of weakly coupled vector particles that mediate the strong interactions. And so how can we put these two things together? Well, since you folks know a little quantum field theory, you know that there is a mechanism in quantum field theory to accomplish this, which is called coupling constant evolution. That is, in quantum field theory, it always happens as a result of renormalization effects that coupling constants have different values depending on the length scale. In a renormalizable quantum field theory, coupling constant evolution is governed by the renormalization group equation, namely dg d log q is equal to the beta function of q. And so we can solve that equation. Francois David, I think, discussed this with you, yes?
You said beta of q.
Sorry, beta of g.
Okay.
That's what I meant. Beta is a function of the coupling constant. You solve this differential equation to find the coupling constant evolution. And roughly, if beta of g is greater than 0, g increases toward the ultraviolet, and it decreases in the infrared. And this is what you might think of in electrodynamics as the usual situation. You start out with a very strong charge at small distances. There's some dielectric effects that make the charge appear weaker as you go out to large distances. But there's an alternative, which is that beta of g could be less than 0. And in that case, g increases toward the infrared, and it decreases toward the ultraviolet. And this is apparently the situation in the strong interactions. The coupling is strong at large distances. It's weak at small distances. So now we can ask, well, there are physical pictures that generate this. But what kind of a physical picture would generate this? And so what I'd like to do today is to compute the beta function in some representative field theories. And roughly, we'll try and find one for which the beta function is negative. So as I understand, this is right on the margin of where Francois got to in his lectures. So I hope that I'll stay on the good side and not the bad side of the margin. But if I wander over, you guys should ask me questions. OK, I'd like to start by computing the beta function in quantum electrodynamics. So let's consider the running of the coupling constant in quantum electrodynamics. So in quantum electrodynamics, there's a relatively straightforward physical picture from which we can compute the running of the coupling constant. We start out with, let's say, two very heavy sources, and we exchange a photon between them. And the photon propagator, of course, is minus I e squared over q squared. And this generates a Coulomb potential equal to minus e squared over q squared. And so now we can ask, when we compute the radiative corrections to this process, what are the effects? And in particular, if we look at those radiative corrections at large distance and then at a succession of smaller distances, can we sum them up into a q squared evolution of the coupling constant? So now let me just draw the diagrams in the next order that affect this process. So there are three kinds of diagrams. There are self-energy diagrams like that. There are vertex diagrams like this. And there are so-called vacuum polarization diagrams like that. Now, in QED, it happens that these two classes of diagrams cancel. And they cancel formally by virtue of the Ward identity, which I'm not sure is a term that you've heard. Very roughly, they cancel by virtue of the fact that in QED, a property of QED is that the charge of the electron divided by the charge of the proton, which is minus 1 in the leading order of perturbation theory, is not renormalized. So if you start out with integer charge relations in QED, that relation that things have integer ratios is preserved to all orders in perturbation theory. And maybe I should say QED had better work like this, because we know that this ratio is 1 to about 20 decimal places experimentally. Yes?
You said that ratio is negative 1 to first order in perturbation?
No. So this is equal to 1 to leading order in perturbation theory. That is, we assign the electron a charge minus 1 relative to the proton. If you now compute the radiative corrections, as I say, this is not renormalized. So the radiative corrections are 0, strictly 0.
Okay.
And that had better be true, because we know that the electron to proton charge ratio is 1 to about 20 decimal places. Okay. And so basically, however field theory messes with the state, it messes with the vertex in the same way, in such a way that those don't affect the normalization of potential. Yes?
Where does the proton appear in QED?
Well, we could, you know, instead of my fundamental source here, I could have some very complicated source with composite interactions, and these are gluons. So, but this is still the photon.
Okay, so you're putting several Dirac fermions.
So I could put several Dirac fermions in a bound state, and I could compute these same corrections. And whatever I put here, these diagrams cancel these diagrams. And that ensures that those diagrams give no correction to the ratio of charges. And this is formally guaranteed by something called the word identity, which I'm not going to discuss in this lecture. OK, so what that means is that the only thing that actually corrects the Coulomb potential are the vacuum polarizations. So that then leaves a quite simple task. We just have to compute the vacuum polarization diagrams. So and actually, we can do even better than that. We can go to higher orders. So let the sum of all one particle irreducible vacuum polarization diagrams be equal to I pi mu nu of q squared. Then I claim that, well, that the corrections to the Coulomb potential just come from this geometric series. And so we can actually sum up that geometric series. Roughly, it'll be e squared over q squared, and then so roughly, we'll get then as the sum of that geometric series. Here's the leading term. And then it'll be basically minus pi. We'll have to do a little better on the indices. I should do that right now. OK, now what's the structure of pi mu nu of q squared? Well, if I tug on the photon lines, what you'll see is that each one will reveal an electromagnetic current. So pi mu nu of q squared is actually a correlation function of electromagnetic currents. And the electromagnetic current is conserved. So that means that q mu, pi mu nu of q, is equal to 0. So that means that pi mu nu must have the structure I q squared g mu nu minus q mu q nu times something I'll call pi of q squared. So this was a function of the momentum. This is only a function of the invariant. So current conservation plus Lorentz invariance requires this form. I could rewrite this, if you like, as q squared times pi of q squared times this object. This is a projection operator. And so if I multiply this by the propagator minus I over q squared, now it's kind of obvious how to sum the geometric series. Yes?
I get confused what you mean by an electromagnetic current in this context, because I'm used to that being a moving spirit. Are you saying that there's electrons in that vacuum polarized?
Yeah, so for example, here, there are electrons in the vacuum polarization. This is the operator that appears here is psi bar gamma mu psi, which is just j mu, the electromagnetic current of the electrons or quarks or whatever. Okay. So if I write that geometric series over there, the leading term is minus I over q squared g mu nu. The next term is minus I over q squared times g mu nu times this thing, I q squared pi g mu nu minus q mu q nu over q squared. And then there's another minus I over q squared, and so on. And so then, let's see, lots of things cancel here. And so you can see that this series is now going to be 1 plus pi plus pi squared plus pi cubed, et cetera. And so the series will sum up to this, minus I over q squared times 1 minus pi of q squared times g mu nu minus q mu q nu over q squared plus something multiplying whatever's left over, which will be of the structure q mu q nu over q squared. And then I need to take into account the e's from the two ends, so there'll be an e squared here. And then that'll be the sum of these diagrams. Oh, yes?
Can you go m over y q dot pi 0?
Where, sorry?
Over y q mu pi mu nu of q is 0.
Oh.
Could you just overlap?
Because this is pi is the Fourier transform of a current-current correlation function. And q mu is just taking d mu of that. And d mu j mu is 0. Okay?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So, okay, so this is 0. So that implies this structure. That structure allows us to write this set of diagrams very simply and sum them up. This is the answer. When I dot q mu into the electromagnetic current on the source, that will vanish. Again, d mu j mu equals 0. And so the answer we'll get for the effective Coulomb potential is just what I wrote up there, e squared over q squared times 1 over 1 minus pi of q squared. So that's a very simple result. And if you like, we could consider this to give the Coulomb potential. And we could consider this structure over here to be the Q-dependent electric charge. And as we'll see, this is a power law dependence. This thing will depend on Q logarithmically. And so that'll be a very sensible thing to do. OK. Now, there's something important here to notice, which is that the electric charge that I measure at large distances, so the E physical, the thing that I would actually measure if I measure Coulomb potentials macroscopically, is not E squared. It's E squared minus 1 minus pi over 1 minus pi of 0. So we would say this is the bare charge. And this whole quantity here is the physical or renormalized charge. Now, I think Francois did tell you, so please. Because I'm doing a macroscopic experiment.
Okay,
so a macroscopic experiment corresponds to momentum transfers, which are extremely small compared to atomic scale. So, okay. So in a macroscopic experiment, I measure this charge. Now, Francois, I think, told you about renormalized perturbation theory. And in renormalized and if you actually compute pi of 0 in perturbation theory, which we will do in a moment, you find out that it's ultraviolet divergent. It's infinite. So this doesn't obviously make sense. But what Francois told you is that a sensible thing to do is to basically adjust the bare charge. One way to do that is to subtract something from this so that pi of 0 equals 0. And then these two quantities will be equal. And then you can do perturbation theory with that prescription. And so that's the prescription I'll adopt, that I'm going to replace pi of q by pi of q squared minus pi of 0. And then that will make the charge that I'm using in perturbation theory equal to the physical charge. And then this still has some residual q squared dependence, which will be a prediction of the theory. So that's the renormalization program insofar as we'll need it today. Yes?
That's the counter term?
Yes, so this would be the counter term for this divergent quantity. Okay. Okay. Well, now we're doing excellently. So now all that remains is to actually compute the effect. And I'm going to compute the effect in leading order in perturbation theory. Namely, I'd like to compute this diagram. So let me erase everything except, oh, that's fine. Let's erase everything. And let's now compute this Feynman diagram with electrons in the loop. So that's minus IE squared. There's a minus 1 because there's a fermion loop. There's, let me label it carefully, Q, K plus Q, K, D4K over 2 pi to the fourth, the trace of K plus Q plus M, gamma mu K plus M, gamma nu divided by K plus Q squared minus M squared, K squared minus M squared. Okay? So now we just have to compute this integral. And now we will have, then we will have the value of pi of Q squared. And that'll tell us then just immediately how the charge varies as a function of Q squared. Okay so far? Okay, so now you need some tricks to do this integral. So there are two tricks that will suffice for today. The first one is a trick called Feynman parameters. Namely, Feynman noticed the very useful identity 1 over ab is equal to the integral dx, x, 1 minus xb squared. So that allows us to combine the two denominators into a single denominator, which is much easier to integrate over, obviously. So let me, oh, I'm sorry. And there should be an I here because each propagator has an I. So this is now equal to minus e squared, the integral dx, the integral d4k. Let's do the trace. That's pretty straightforward. It's 4k plus q mu k nu plus k plus q nu k mu minus k dot k plus q plus m squared. This is g mu nu, g mu nu. And now, using Feynman's trick, I can combine the denominators in the following way as x times k plus q squared plus 1 minus x times k squared minus m squared, the quantity squared. Okay? Now, here's what you do with the new denominator. You write it as k squared plus 2x q squared plus x plus 2x k dot q plus x q squared minus m squared. You then shift k so it's more symmetrical. So let me write a boldface k is equal to k plus x q. So then k is equal to the, and k plus q, which we'll also need, is equal to k plus 1 minus xq. And then this thing is the beginning of boldface k squared. And when I complete the square, there's an x squared q squared term. So this is x minus x squared q squared minus m squared. And then this is just a simple shift, so I can change my integration variable to k. And then what you see is that this is a nice symmetric integral over k. And so let me then substitute these expressions in the numerator. And so then we'll get minus 4e squared. The integral dx from 0 to 1, I'm now integrating over k. K mu k nu from here and here. There's minus k squared g mu nu. Let me put the m squared also. Then there are some terms that you see are k mu times q nu. And because the rest of the integral is symmetric, those terms are going to vanish. And they'd better vanish because a term k mu q nu, when I integrate over k, if it didn't vanish, it would just be proportional to q nu and nothing else. And that wouldn't be Lorentz invariant. So if I want a Lorentz invariant answer, I'd better arrange that all these terms cancel. And then what's left are the quadratic terms in q nu, one from here and one from here, which you see are of the form minus x times 1 minus x q mu q nu, and there are two of those. Okay. And so after all those manipulations, this thing turns into this, plus terms in the numerator that are linear in k, which should vanish after symmetric integration. Now, it's clear that this expression has an easy part and a hard part. The easy part is the integral over the term q mu q nu. So that is exactly the following thing. Minus 4e squared, the integral over k, 1 over k squared plus the other stuff in the denominator, minus 2x times 1 minus x q mu q nu. Now, this integral is divergent, but it's only logarithmically divergent. Let's evaluate it. Here we need one more trick, which is the Wick rotation, which I guess you folks did discuss. I want to turn this into a Euclidean integral so that I can evaluate it easily. So what you do is that you replace k0 by I k Euclidean. And then you get a factor of I coming out. So this becomes 8e squared I times the integral d4 over the Euclidean k. When I change this k squared to Euclidean, it becomes minus k squared. But it's squared, so that's fine. And then in the numerator, I took out the minus 2. So I have x times 1 minus x times q mu q nu and the integral dx. The integral d4k is pi squared k Euclidean squared dk Euclidean squared, for those of you who are good at four-dimensional geometry. The area of the unit sphere in four dimensions is, I'll write the formula. The area of the unit sphere in four dimensions is 2 pi squared. So from that, you can derive this formula. And so now we're done. There's a pi squared up here. It cancels some of the denominator, but not all. So we end up with plus 8e squared I over 16 pi squared. There's an integral over x times 1 minus x left. There's a q mu q nu. And from the integral, we get the log of, if I cut off this at some value lambda, lambda squared. And then by dimensional analysis, what's in the denominator is some linear combination of q squared and m squared. And I'm not going to much care what that is, so let me just leave it in this form. And then this integral here, you can easily do. And the value is 1/6. And so now we've completely reduced that integral to a visible factor. OK, well, now we're doing truly excellently. So the only problem now is to calculate the other terms in here. So this is proportional to g mu nu. This term is proportional to g mu nu. And when I symmetrically integrate over this term, that can only be proportional to g mu nu by Lorentz invariants. However, there's a problem with these terms here. You notice that they're quadratically divergent. So a quadratic divergence is much worse than a logarithmic divergence. A logarithmic divergence means it's practically not divergent. So anything that's subleading to the log divergence is finite. And because I'm mainly interested here in the lambda squared behavior, we can ignore it. But for a quadratic divergence, I'm interested in the subleading log divergence under the quadratic divergence. And you can see that it's going to be very easy to get that wrong. In particular, a lot of things I've already done are invalidated in a quadratically divergent integral. For example, when I made the shift of integration variables, there's a boundary term that's linearly divergent. When I did the Wick rotation of the contour, there's another boundary term which is linearly divergent. It's a total mess. So what you really need to do, if you want to evaluate this integral carefully, is you need to have an appropriate regulator for the integral, not just a simple cutoff like I did here, but some kind of appropriate regulator that can deal with all these problems. Callum will tell you how to do that this afternoon. But fortunately, for this particular integral, there's a nice solution, which is that we know that the structure of the answer must be like this, purely on the grounds of electromagnetic current conservation. So once we've computed the Q mu Q nu term, it's obvious what the Q squared term has to be. If the Q squared term turns out to be something different, that means that our ultraviolet regulator violated current conservation, which is a no-no. So now we're done. Let me just write down the answer. So combining the factors here, we get I e squared, let's see, 8 over 16 sixths is a third, 3 pi squared, times Q mu Q nu. And then we have the log of lambda squared over a q squared plus b m squared. Actually, it's minus q squared here. It's the space like q squared. And so that means that we now know what the value of this integral has to be. It's minus I e squared over 3 pi squared times q squared g mu nu minus q mu q nu times the log of lambda squared divided by some linear combination of q squared and m squared. Okay? Maybe I should tell you, if you want to know all the constant terms in here and have a really clean evaluation of this integral, you can find one in the last section of Chapter 7 of my book. But this is all we'll need for today. Okay, now what I need to do is to subtract the value at q squared equals 0. So now I want to subtract something like the log of lambda squared over b m squared. So that's the renormalization counter term. So that subtraction will ensure that the e squared that I'm doing perturbation theory in is actually the physical coupling. And so then the final answer for the QED vacuum polarization diagram is plus I e squared over 3 pi squared times q squared, maybe let's put this first, g mu nu q squared minus q mu q nu. And then what's here is the contribution to pi. And that's now got a plus sign, e squared over 3 pi squared times the log of q squared over m squared plus some constant factors related to a over b. OK? So now we're all set. Now we just have to see what the implication of that is. So as I said before, E of E squared of Q squared is equal to E squared, the coupling constant at large distances, times 1 minus pi, and pi is this. And now you see that this is exactly what we might have thought, that as Q squared gets large, So you have a larger momentum transfer. This term is positive. It cancels away from the 1. It makes E of q squared larger. And so the electromagnetic coupling gets larger and larger as we go to shorter and shorter distances or larger and larger momentum. And this exactly accords with your naive picture of what the vacuum in QED is doing. We start with some kind of large charge here. We have lots of electrons and positrons that appear as vacuum fluctuations. They polarize the vacuum. They provide an effective dielectric constant. And so at larger distances, the QED coupling constant should become smaller. But macroscopic distances is where we measure the charge. And so as we penetrate the screening cloud, we'll see a larger and larger charge. Maybe I should say that, and then we can actually get the value of the beta function. If I take dE squared, if I compute dE d log q, so this thing here, of course, is q squared. dE d log q is equal to 1 over 2e dE squared d log q. So that's equal to 1 over 2e of q. Let's call this e0, the large distance charge. E0 squared divided by, then we'll get the denominator squared. Then we'll get another E0 squared divided by 3 pi squared. And we'll get a, the derivative with respect to the log q, it has a 2. And the 2's cancel. And that, and that will add up to the fourth power of the charge. And so when the smoke clears, we'll get the following equation. E squared squared over 3 pi squared divided by E. So this will be E cubed over 3 pi squared. And that's the beta function of quantum electrodynamics. I really screwed up. Yeah. So way back here it should have been 12. So I had 8 divided by 16 pi squared divided by 6, which is well known to be 4/3 times 16 pi squared, which is well known to be 12. So I'm sorry. And then this should be 12. And then this should be 12, and this should be 12. Please excuse me. Okay. Good. Okay. Yes.
Bring it back a bit. Initially, you chose the function pi mu.
Yes.
Say g mu nu minus q mu q nu. Wouldn't you expect pi mu nu to be symmetric under switching mu and nu?
It is.
Let's figure out the negative sign.
Sorry? Well, q mu, q nu, if I switch mu and nu, it turns into itself.
Yes, but g mu nu grows a negative sign.
Sorry, no, g mu nu, when I switch mu and nu, it's symmetric.
Right, okay. No.
Totally symmetric. Okay. So as I emphasized, I didn't choose this form. It chose us. It's required. Okay. Good. Now, this isn't the entire beta function of QED, because as we go to shorter and shorter distances, I can have vacuum polarization not only produce electrons, but also muons, taus, quarks, etc. So actually, I should write the beta function of QED as e cubed over 12 pi squared times the sum over all flavors of, well, it's 1 for every lepton that becomes involved in the vacuum polarization. And for every quark, I get the quark charge squared times 3 colors. So you can write the formula like this, where Q is the charge of the species, and NF is equal to 1 for a lepton, and it's equal to 3 for a quark. So this is the same factor that appeared in the R in E plus E minus. Yes?
Sorry, just a little confused. I thought QED was exclusively electrons.
No, now we're talking about the real world.
Oh.
So in the real world, this is the beta function, where we sum over flavors such that 2MF is less than my Q. So the beta function is different in different regions depending on how many species can actually be fluctuated in vacuum polarization. No, it's just that I've made the approximation here that Q squared is greater than M squared. Right? So when I said A Q plus B, I implicitly assumed that the Q squared was the larger term.
Okay, so yeah, the mass.
When I wrote this expression. So if that's not true, then a flavor will drop out. And so I'll just write the QED of all quarks and leptons and compute this. And then, as I pass every mass threshold, I'll get a new contribution. Yes?
Is there a good reason to expect that the charge appears with a square?
Yes, because there's one here and one here. So if I have quarks in the loop, I get the quark charge squared. Okay.
So does that mean that our beta function would have like a Q fourth term for the two loop?
Well, be careful. This diagram is already accounted for when I made the resummation. This diagram, on the other hand, where the photon here has a Q loop. Okay, so, and then you can actually, you know, put this into the real world and ask what the value of E squared. So usually we talk about the value of E squared in terms of alpha, which is E squared over 4 pi. And you folks all know that at Q equals 0, the value of alpha is 1 over 137. So if you now integrate up past all the light quark and lepton thresholds to Q equals something like 30 GeV, then the value turns out to be 1 over 130, which is larger. And if I go up to 91 GeV, which will be significant in our discussion of the weak interactions next week, the number is 1 over 129. So a different value of alpha applies if you go to very short distances. Now, if you look at figure 1, this number is actually tested in measurement of baba scattering, E plus E minus to E plus E minus at 30 GeV. And indeed, that's the number you need in order to get the precise agreement of theory and experiment in those experiments. Okay. Let's do one more little example, and then we'll go on to the real stuff that we're interested in. So the one more example that I wanted to do, that's not good, is the QE is the beta function for a scalar field coupled to electrodynamics. So did you folks study the electrodynamics of a scalar field? OK. So then hopefully this will be pretty straightforward. The Lagrangian is sorry? Okay, let's... okay. So the Lagrangian of a scalar field coupled to QED is that, where, so this is d mu plus IE or minus IE a mu phi star d mu plus IE a mu phi minus m squared phi star phi. So then the propagator is I over k squared minus m squared. There's a vertex like this, which is minus IE k plus k prime mu. And there's a vertex like this, a four-point vertex, which is 2i g mu nu times e squared. The vacuum polarization in leading order is now given by two diagrams, this one and this one. This diagram here is completely proportional to g mu nu. So by the logic by which I computed the fermion QED result, let me just leave it aside. It'll be a mess. When you actually compute it correctly, everything will turn out OK. This diagram we have to work a little harder on. So that diagram will be minus I e squared, the integral d4k over 2 pi to the fourth, 1 over k squared minus m squared, k plus q squared minus m squared. Maybe I should label k plus q and k. In the numerator from here, I'll get 2k plus q mu, 2k plus q nu. Once again, what I'd like to do is to extract, and then plus the other diagram. I'm going to extract the q mu q nu term. So for that, I need that 2k plus q is equal to 2k plus 1 minus 2x times q. So then you see that the integral I get, and there's an I for each propagator. The integral I get will be plus e squared, the integral dx, the integral d4k. There'll be k squared plus something in the denominator. In the numerator, there'll be this factor squared. OK, and then there's also a g mu nu term that we're going to ignore. This is a really easy integral to do. Log of lambda squared over a times q squared plus b m squared. Once again, for the details, you need the real regularization, but we don't care here. The integral dx times 1 minus 2x is 1/3. And now we're done. Times q mu q nu. So the answer here is minus I e squared 48 pi squared q mu q nu. Plus I e squared q mu q nu 48 pi squared log lambda squared over what was in the denominator. And then because of current conservation, again, I can add this term to get the right structure. I now subtract this at q squared equals 0. And so my final answer for the scalar case is that this set of diagrams plus the appropriate counterterm is I times q squared g mu nu minus q mu q nu times e squared over 48 pi squared times the log of minus q squared over m squared. Very good. So it's exactly 1/4 of what we found for the fermionic case. And so in QED, in the purest form of QED that you wanted us to be working in, the beta function is equal to e squared over 12 pi squared for fermions. And it's e cubed, rather, over 48 pi squared for bosons. OK. And in both cases, it's positive. So I've been working for 45 minutes, and I've computed lots of beta functions, and we still haven't found one that has the property that we need to study the strong interactions. So now, clearly, we have to pull out the next thing that's in our back pocket, which is Young-Mills theory. So you guys have written down the Lagrangian for Young-Mills theory. So let me again write down the Lagrangian for Young-Mills theory. So I want to consider, actually, the Young-Mills theory for a vector field coupled to fermions and also coupled to a complex scalar field. So it'll be interesting to consider the beta function for all of these interactions. And as you all know, F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus g f a b c a mu b a nu c. And the covariant derivative is d mu minus I g a mu a t a. And the t, so f a b c is the so-called structure constant of the group that I'm working in. T is a representation matrix for the generators of the group. So this would be the sigma matrices in SU2. I'm going to use a little r to denote what representation I'm in. And the structure constants, the t's are a representation of this algebra. So the structure constants depend on the group. And then I find all t's that satisfy that relation to find the representations of the algebra. OK, now I'd like to do the following thing. We're now interested in the renormalization of the coupling G. Now, when we have a non-abelian gauge theory like this, it's a trickier problem than to calculate the coupling constant renormalization in QED. And the reason for that is that these vertex and self-energy diagrams that I talked about before no longer cancel. And even more unfortunately, they give a contribution to coupling constant renormalization that depends on what gauge you work in. So you have to gauge fix the calculation to do the calculation. And then these values depend on what gauge you're working with. And it's a mess. So to circumvent that, I'm going to use a very fancy trick, which will preserve gauge invariance to the maximum extent possible. First thing that I'd like to do is to get all the g's out of this formula and put them in one place where I can track what's happening to g. So I'm going to rescale a in such a way that a will absorb the g, and then it'll come out here. So after a rescaling of a, that's a totally equivalent way to write this theory. Now what I'd like to do, yes?
We had one G.
There's a G I've sucked into each A. And here, I just had the A by itself. So if I suck a G in, I have to divide by G.
Because there's F mu nu. Never.
Right. So this is now a totally equivalent way to write them. OK, now what I'd like to do is to put the theory in a classical background field of A. So I'm going to write A is equal to A with a classical background field satisfying the classical field equations. D mu F from that A is equal to 0. And then I'm going to write plus a quantum part. And I'm going to hold this fixed, and I'm going to try and integrate over that. Now, if I ignore this, the Lagrangian has the classical value, 1 over 4 g squared f, the f mu nu computed from that squared. This is a gauge invariant expression. And so it has, if you like, sorry, the integral d4x. So it has real physical significance. And then if somehow we can keep control of gauge invariance as we integrate over A, we'll get some correction to this. And the correction I would like to interpret as a change in the coupling constant g squared. So I'll first do this by integrating out the scalar and the fermion. And you'll see that it gives the same result as we got in QED by more elementary methods. And then I'll apply the same logic to the gauge boson. So far, so good? Yes?
So the first term is gauge invariant, d4x over 1.
Right.
And then you're adding terms that are no longer gauge invariant?
No, I'm going to compute the radiative corrections to this by integrating over the fluctuations in A and over psi and phi.
Those are not gauge invariant?
No, those, well, I'm going to set things up so that those corrections will be gauge invariant. And in fact, what they'll do is just correct the coefficient of this term. And the coefficient of this term is my effective value of g. So the radiative corrections will appear as a correction to g. And they will make g q squared dependent. And we'll see that it's exactly what we found in quantum electrodynamics.
So we're renormalizing through the Lagrangian.
That's right. And so I do things this way because the gauge invariance is really clear. And I can't, you know, suck into my, what I think is a physical prediction, gauge-dependent things. So this method is called the background field method. And it's fairly sophisticated, I'm sorry, but really it's, well, what can I say? You'll appreciate it when we're done. Okay. So now we should go to work. We should expand the action as a perturbation series around the background field. And it will suffice to expand to quadratic order in the fluctuating fields, namely A, psi, and phi. So let me do that next. OK. So f mu nu is equal to f mu nu plus d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus fabc a mu a nu plus a mu a nu plus a mu a nu. Okay. Now, this plus this actually go together in a quite nice way. And the reason for that is that here I wrote representation matrices. There's a very special representation of a group, which is that the generators of the group naturally form themselves a representation of the Lie algebra. And in that, so that representation is called the adjoint representation. So it's the representation of the Lie algebra in which the generators live. So in SU2, it's a three-dimensional representation. In SU3, it would be an eight-dimensional representation. And in that, representation, the representation matrices are I, F, A, B, C. So B is the index label here. A and C are other generators. So this is acts on a generator and it gives you another generator. And you can show that these objects actually satisfy this computational relation. And of course, the gauge fields are supposed to be in, there's one gauge field for every generator, so that's in this representation. And if I look at this thing, that FABC, if I multiply by minus I times I, I can make one of these. And so I can write this as F mu nu plus D mu A nu minus D nu A mu, and then plus this last term, plus FABC A mu B A nu C. Okay. So the covariant derivative with respect to the background field comes in. And so that's what's going to happen now. Everything's going to be very covariant with respect to the background field. OK, so now let's square this. So F mu nu squared is equal to F mu nu squared. Now there are terms that are linear because I multiply this from one F times this from the other F. However, you can see that when I integrate by parts, I get d mu on f mu nu. And that's the equation of motion. So the linear terms vanish. OK, now we're doing good. Now the quadratic terms are the square of this thing, which would be something like a mu d squared minus d nu d mu acting on a nu, actually that way. And then there's a term which has this and this, which is 2. Oh, and I get 2 of those when I square this. And then 2 f mu nu a FABC a mu b a mu c. Now, I'd like to reverse the order here. And so there's another something that you, I hope you know about Young-Mills theory, that the commutator of covariant derivatives is f mu nu. OK, namely, it's d mu acting on a nu and the other d mu acting on the other a nu, and then the quadratic term in A turns out to work out correctly. You can check. So I can reverse the order and get another factor of F, which it turns out adds up precisely with this equation. And when the smoke clears, I get the following expression, F squared is equal to minus 1 over 4 G squared F squared minus 1 over 2 G squared times a mu minus d squared plus d mu d nu, now in the other order, a nu, plus an extra term, which is minus 2 a mu f mu nu a nu f a b c. OK? And yeah, that's good. OK, now, yes?
The term with d squared acting a mu with the name in front.
Oh, g mu nu.
OK.
I should have written that here. That comes from the square of this term. And the square of this term. OK. Now we're doing truly excellently. And then, of course, plus higher order terms in A. And I claimed I only had to take this to quadratic order. And then the other term, these terms are already quadratic in the fluctuations. Now there's one more thing that I have to do. I have to gauge fix. Yes. Sorry?
How much time we got
left? May I go just exceptionally today another 10 minutes?
I have to check whether that's actually reading. Yep, it's your name. Is that the 10 minutes okay?
I don't know if you can speak to me.
Hirani is giving her first lecture.
Yeah, I'm not sure we should. Can we maybe have time to think about this and start again tomorrow here?
No, because we're almost there. Because all the materials have now been prepared.
It's exciting, then. People will turn up to the lecture tomorrow.
Sorry?
People will come tomorrow to see what happens.
We're almost done.
10 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll be nicer tomorrow. Today I want to steal it.
Okay.
Okay. So now we have to gauge fix. And the gauge fixing, obviously, is going to be something like d mu a nu a is equal to 0. So that's a covariant gauge fixing with respect to the background field. And the nicest thing to do is actually to go to Feynman gauge, which means that this term will disappear. And so now, finally, we end up with the following expression. Minus 1 over 4 g squared f squared, and then minus 1 over 2 g squared, and then for this a term, we'll get a mu minus d squared g mu nu a, this is on the gauge indices, we'll get ghosts, and the ghost action, you won't be surprised, will be this. We'll get fermions, and just in the background field, because we're already quadratic, and we'll get scalars. And so that's now the almost complete expression. Now I'd like to just play one more trick, and then we can calculate, which is that when I integrate over the fermions, I'm going to get the determinant of d slash to the power of the number of fermions in the theory. Now I'd like to write this as the square root of the determinant of d slash squared. So I'm going to square the d slash, and then eventually I have to take half the number of fermions. I d slash squared is given by the following expression, gamma mu d mu minus gamma nu d nu. Now, for the gammas, I can symmetrize and anti-symmetrize. Now, this is just g mu nu. So this term is going to give me minus d squared. So now the fermion term will look just like everything else. And this term gives me the following thing. S mu nu is equal to I over 4, the commutator of gammas, is the representation of angular momentum on the fermion state. And please notice I have the commutator of d's, that's going to give me an f mu nu. So this will be 2, when the smoke clears, times a half f mu nu, s mu nu, and that's the complete operator now. And then the f is dotted into some matrix in the representation. Yes?
Sure. Quite often you freely integrate by parts in the gradient. So your equal signs are only the integral of one side is equal to the integral of the other.
No. I just squared this operator. I've integrated by parts.
Okay, and also before at some point.
And now what's very cool is that this term here turns out to be the same form. In the vector representation, S mu nu alpha beta is delta mu alpha delta nu beta minus delta nu alpha delta mu beta. So this term also has this structure, but now T is the representation matrix in the adjoint representation, And S is this matrix, which is the generator of angular momentum in the vector representation. So now everything is working extremely well. Let delta be equal to minus d squared plus 2 times 1 half background f mu nu s mu nu ta. This depends on the spin of the particle and the representation. And everything is now cast in this form. So the Lagrangian is the classical term. Plus the A field with a delta, the psi field, where I have to remember that I only integrate over half the number of fermions, with the delta corresponding to spin a half and its representation, spin one and the adjoint representation. The ghosts are spin zero in the adjoint representation, and the scalars are spin zero and whatever representation they're in. Okay. Actually, you know, maybe I'd better stop. Okay. So now I've cast the whole problem into this, into these terms. And in, if you guys really get here at 9 tomorrow, I will wrap everything up and we will compute the beta function in Young-Mills theory. OK? So let me stop there. That's the end of the lecture. OK, and I think you wanted to make an announcement.